All right. Welcome to Multimedia Security. Last week, so today I would like to talk about a different class of image forensics methods, so-called physics-based methods. Physics-based image forensics. This is a topic that I like a lot, but it does not receive a lot of attention in the forensics community. So the overall motivation is, so why physics-based? The goal of physics-based methods is to validate specific physical properties in the scene. For example, we have direct illumination, like what we have here, and the person is standing on the ground, then there should be a shadow somewhere at the feet of that person. Yeah? And the direction of the shadow, it should be like on the other side of the sun, loosely speaking. Hmm? For example, under direct illumination, from a single source, let's be a little bit more precise to avoid complications. A person has a shadow that is on the other side than the light source. Okay, so far so simple. But if we think about this, we already have a bunch of physical assumptions in there. So common assumptions are a single dominant light source, so this allows to examine the direction of incident light. Or the spectral distribution, so the color spectral distribution. Of light. We can make an assumption that we are located on a ground plane, for example. So we have a clearly recognizable ground plane. And then look at the shadows cast onto that plane. So cast shadow direction on plane and the shadow, cast shadow height or length, I don't know. Shadows have a length, right? So it's a cast shadow length on that plane that we can measure, yeah? Or different thing are optical effects, yeah? So talking about measuring lengths, we can also use like, let's say, clearly recognizable vanishing points that should be consistent. What are vanishing points? Aha. Yeah, okay. This is not the computer vision lecture. It's fine. Yeah.
From a perspective.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I always remember one art lesson where we trained to paint like this.
Yeah. Right. It's
line buildings like a perspective like one.
Yes, it's a concept that comes essentially from perspective projection. We always have perspective projection in our normal type cameras, yeah. And when we take a picture of a building and we're standing in front of that building or at some corner of that building and are taking a picture of that building, it might look like this, yeah. Sorry, I'm messing up. So imagine there are windows here, yeah? And when you're naively looking at that picture, it looks as if the upper like lines of these windows, for example, you have right angles everywhere. But if you would connect these with lines, it looks as if these lines would converge in some point, not necessarily within the image, but somewhere outside of the image. Yeah. So these are the vanishing lines, and the point where they connect are vanishing points. And the same thing also, so that, I mean, we are in 3D, so there are also three directions of vanishing lines. Yeah. So and now you could say, if I have a picture with a couple of buildings, they all have right angles everywhere. Yeah. Then you could compute on each of these buildings the vanishing lines, look where these vanishing points are, and then use this as a consistency measure. Assuming that if the picture is a composite from multiple sources, that the vanishing lines don't fit together. Yeah, that would be like a typical, like optics motivated physics-based criterion. Yeah. But you need this, like the clearly recognizable, vanishing lines, probably more accurate than vanishing points. So the clearly recognizable vanishing lines. So this means it only works in man-made environments. No, it doesn't help a lot in nature because there you don't have these right angles, which are so necessary in order to observe the perspective distortion here. Okay. So the same thing here. These assumptions, they don't work in every situation. Yeah, a single dominant light source. I think this is an assumption that is okay if you are outdoors. No, you have the sun. So if you are outdoors and you have a clear sky, then it's fine. Yeah, it doesn't work like in the winter weather here, like with a cloud cover, for example. It's you would not call this a single light source. It's still just one sun, but there's so much interreflections that it's like one large super extended light source. Yeah, and then that's typically a violation against this assumption. Also, indoor scenes are complicated because typically you have more than one light source indoors. Like, for example, you have light coming through the window and you have a local light here from the ceiling and ta-da, already two lights, you know? Or you have some interreflections. That's also a source of confusion. okay, so these physics-based methods, the reason why they are not so popular is that they always come with assumptions of this type. Yeah, so assumptions on the scene content, on the content of the scene, and they are only applicable if there's a specific situation in the scene that can be exploited. But then, but if that is the case, then it's cool because then you have a specific property that you can actually measure from that image. and you sort of know the ground truth from your physical assumptions on the scene. So, strong assumptions. Our main limiting factor. For application. So yes, please.
What would be an example for a not clearly recognizable ground plane?
Oh, yeah, it's maybe not so exact this expression, but you could have a situation like where you have a picture of a person. For example, that is not on the stones here, but instead on this like earth-like ground next to it. Yeah, and then you're trying to measure the length of the shadow, and you wonder is it consistent with other persons, but you're not really certain that you have a perfect plane there, or it could have some local curvature, and then your measurement is not really an indication. Like if you have a difference in the shadow length, for example, it's not an indication that the picture is inconsistent. Yeah. So we have strong assumptions, and only if they are satisfied, we can really be confident to apply these methods. On the other hand, if such an assumption is satisfied, we can use prior physical knowledge to set up strong, I mean, theoretically strong consistency criteria. So really in a forensic sense, you can say, okay, if I, like, then I can have a, like, a proof from my assumptions to the image. Let me show you a couple of examples. Hani Farid did a lot of work on this, and I'm just showing you a little bit. Hani Farid and his group, of course, did a lot of work on this. Just going to show you a couple of pictures. By the way, just because I'm seeing this here, did you hear about this deep fakes framework or read about it? Not? Ah, you should. Let me show this to you really quickly. I just saw it in my browser, so sorry, it's a small detour. So deep fakes. Here, for example, for some reason, I missed that meme, but people like Nicolas Cage, and they are putting his face everywhere, like in every... So this is Superman putting Nicolas Cage here, and then they are like this, Indiana Jones, sort of Nicolas Cage. Cage versus Cage, yeah, that was, yeah. So, okay, so people are messing around with a tool that has been. Well, sorry. Yeah, okay, so it's a typical internet thing, but if you look for deep fakes, the first hit is essentially is a link to a Reddit channel where you can essentially download an app to create this type of manipulations. And I think mostly the intention was to use it for pornography in order to, like, take existing porn movies and maybe put Nicolas Cage in there. Or other, like, I don't know. But of course, I mean, you can take any videos, no? The workings are relatively straightforward, similar to what Mark Stamminger did with the face-to-face. Maybe you saw it. I don't know. If you didn't, let me take a little bit. A further detour here. So Justus worked on this. So essentially how it works is that face to face, yeah. So the way how it works is that you detect a face, you fit a 3D morphable model to that face. And then if you have that 3D model, you can re-render the face. So you're estimating the facial expression, for example, or something from another person, and then can render it over the original face. Yeah. So can you see this? It's a little bit bright here, but anyways, so actually the tracker is tracking this face and that face, yeah? And then it's transferring, like it's reconstructing a 3D model of this face and then tracking the facial gestures from the other face, transferring them on the 3D model of this face and rendering it back on top. So this is not super specific, to be honest, for this lab. I mean, it's not like we opened the gates of hell or something, but it's a topic that has been researched for a number of years. But there are there is a steady progress, no, to make it more real time, to make it more realistically looking. And in that context, so the face to face work was really nice because it could operate with a very nice quality. It could operate in real time. That was the contribution of this work. No? Right. So here's an illustration, no? You're tracking source target. You take the expression of the source and then move it, like render it over the target. No? Okay. But there are a number of related works and apparently this deep fakes guy implemented one of them. I don't know. I did not yet look into the details. And is offering, you don't find it ad hoc, but if you go through these links, I mean, is essentially offering a program to download and such that you can create your own deep fakes. Yeah. Okay. So that's more like an Outlook type of thing. So I think in the forensics community has to deal in the very near future with a lot of computer generated stuff, no? Because it's really like we are at a point right now where it really becomes feasible for non-experts to create computer generated material. No? The hardware is not so expensive, the software is there. No? And okay, but this is not what I questions to this or so, because otherwise I would continue with physics-based stuff. Okay. Good. Physics-based stuff. Sorry, completely different topic now. So this is Hani Farid, by the way. And he's been working on these physics-based methods for quite a while because he's originally also a computer graphics, computer vision person. So I guess this physics-based stuff is just like something that is also very natural when he thinks about these types of problems. So, and there are some very specific, but also very nice works on his webpage. Like, for example, exposing digital forgeries through specular highlights on the eye. and this, I think, this was an actual case, that where someone asked him for his expert assessment. So the allegation was, I think, that this is a manipulation, and it was somehow about, so it was about some money involved. It's not a political case, it's from show business. This was a high quality photograph. And the question was it original or not? And what Hani did is that essentially he looked at the specular highlights in the eye, in order to show that the distribution of environment lights was different, for these persons. And in order to achieve this, he said, like, yeah, okay, so if this is the eye, let's say it's a perfect sphere, Then we have a normal vector. We have a vector pointing towards the light source or a number of light sources in a studio environment. You have the camera. So it's a typical physics-based model. No? And then reasons, okay, if I make this and this and this observation on the eye surface, then I can sort of reproject this in the scene and make a guess on the distribution of lights in the scene. Okay, and there are a number of details involved, Okay, and he explains these things. So these are really cool works in the sense that that you have a model and you say, okay, if this model holds, and this can be sort of independently evaluated, like for example, is an eye like a sphere or so? Yeah. Let's ask a medical doctor or so, and he can tell. And then if these assumptions hold, then the calculation that we do on top of the observations is like this and this, and then it's consistent or not. Yeah. Or here's another interesting question. It feels almost a little bit like I showed you this already. Did I show you the Zapruder film already? I did. Yeah. Okay. A reconstruction of the JFK assassination on a specific video frame, and Hani reconstructed the president and then the whole composition of the scene in order to make a statement whether the back of the head, whether it's plausibly that dark or if it may be subject to some editing or so. And his finding was like, yeah, it makes sense that it is that dark, like at the rear part of his head. Okay. Good. So here's a list of such works. And what I would like to specifically show is some of his work on estimating the direction of the incident light on a person. Sorry, this is not related. Let me switch this off. Okay. I think I like these physics-based methods so much because if you think of forensics in a way, maybe more like how Felix Freiling interprets the word or so, no? Then I think the physics-based methods really come close to it because you have a chain of conclusions that you draw from a picture based on some more or less verifiable assumptions, yeah? But some well-understood model, you have to assess the extent to which this model holds. So it's pretty much... forensics without much guessing or so, no? Okay. Example method is from Johnson and Farid, 2007. Estimate the lighting environment. of an object. And lighting environment means the distribution of incident light. Yeah. Okay. And the underlying assumption is this. So if you look at a photograph, so the human eye is not so great in really distinguishing directions of incident light. Yeah. So oftentimes you wonder, is this a realistic lighting situation or not? But you don't really have the tools to quantify it or so. Yeah, you can argue about it, but you cannot quantify it. And this approach should provide a numerical method to compute these lighting environments and then to be able to compare it also. So we have a numerical method to compute a lighting environment. And to compare it. Okay, how does it work? The idea is, so let's say we have a known object, yeah? To keep it simple, let's say we have a gray ball in the scene. Okay, if we have a gray ball, then we certainly know color is not a problem. It's a uniform, a perfectly uniform gray ball. So color is not a problem. And the surface normals are known because we know in the center, it's sort of pointing directly to the camera. And then to the outside, well, okay, the normals spread up and we can calculate what the surface normals are. And another thing is known, namely the shading at each of these surface normals. Yeah. So the question is, so given a gray ball or some other, we can generalize this later. Yeah. Given a gray ball. Yeah. So this means known color. Known surface normals, and known intensities, like reflected intensities, no? That's the brightness that we observe. Known reflected intensities. Can we, so, or no, it's an idea, so it needs to be a statement. So given a gray ball, let's compute the position of the light source. Yeah. So that means for example, here it's brighter and then towards the outside it becomes darker. Yeah. But since it's a very regular ball, since we know the surface normals, yeah, we can say if we know how incident light and then exiting light behaves, so we need some model that links surface normal, color, okay, color is neutral here, so we don't care. Yeah, we need a model that links the surface normal to the intensity. And then we can solve a system of equations or so that satisfies that model. And that should give us as one variable the direction where the light comes from. Yeah? Okay, so the transport of or transformation of incident light from a specific angle to exiting light is called a reflectance function. What's the simplest commonly used reflectance function? Did anyone hear computer graphics or something? Or anything else? Nothing? It's Lambertian. So let's assume we have Lambertian reflectance so that is a purely diffuse reflectance, no specular highlights or fancy stuff, yeah? So that is a purely diffuse then the angle of incidence and the angle of exitance is linked by a cosine. Like we compute the cosine of the angle and that's it. Okay, so that means we can take this cosine relationship and sort of invert it. So we can look at the actual brightness that we observed. We know the surface normal, so we know one angle. We know the brightness that we saw. And then we calculate backwards and know, okay, so if we have that brightness here, then it must come from an angle of this and this magnitude. Yeah? Okay, not from a single point, but if we have the distribution of all brightnesses, we know the brightest spot looks like this, the darkest like this. So this is the range of brightnesses, and they have to be linked through a cosine. Then we can solve that. Yeah. Okay. So let's assume we have Lambertian reflectance, that is purely diffuse reflectance. Then the observed intensity is the incident intensity multiplied by a cosine between the angle of incidence and exitance. Let's make a sketch really quickly and then it hopefully it becomes clearer. So let's say we look at the sphere and we know okay, here we have this surface normal, yeah. So this is a surface normal. N. And the light, or let's make the arrow in the other direction to have the angle nicer. The light source is at some, comes from some direction V. So that means we have some angle alpha between the incident light and the surface normal. Hold on. Then the observed intensity is the incident intensity multiplied by cosine between the angle of incidence and, sorry, and the surface normal. Right. And with the Lambertian assumption, it means it doesn't matter from which direction we look at this point. The observed intensity is always the same. So it doesn't depend on the viewer position. It only depends on the surface normal and the position of the light source. Okay. So that means if we look from here and we observe a certain brightness and then we look here, for example, and observe another brightness, yeah? So we know that the surface, since we know the surface normals, so again we have the V here, but we have another normal N2 here, for example, yeah? Then we can see, okay, we know there's a cosine relationship between these two intensities. Our surface normals changed, but we know the surface normals, so we can solve for V, and the position of that V must explain the change in intensities. Yeah. Okay, so differently expressed, or the other way around. Given surface normals Ni and associated intensities I is bad, Ji, we can solve for the direction of a single light source at infinite distance. So this is in direction V. Yeah? In our sketch, that was the V. Sorry, here. Yeah? So if we have a single light source at infinite distance, it means all rays are parallel. Yeah. So we don't need to bother about some divergence of the rays or so. Yeah. So all V's have identical direction. Yeah. And we can directly use our intensity distribution and the surface normals to solve for V. Yeah, that's the whole idea. And now when you think of, I don't know, just math. okay, so we have V. Since this is a three-dimensional sphere, so let's say all vectors are three-dimensional. Yeah, so that means we only have three unknowns. Yeah, V has three coordinates. It's a 3D vector. We have three unknowns. That means that essentially three points suffice to triangulate to solve for V, no? Three unknowns, three equations, we're done, yeah? Okay. And that's in principle true, no? We could say, okay, so common image processing wisdom is that if we use more data and then make some regression towards a value V that's more robust because we always have noise in our measurements. That's also true, yeah? But 3 points would suffice, no? Okay, now it turns out if we have more than 3 points, what we can estimate is not just a single, like the direction of a single light source, but we can estimate the coefficients of a whole lighting environment. Yeah. So this idea, so let me write this down. This idea can be extended to estimate not just a single light position, light direction V, but instead the whole hemisphere of incident light. Hemisphere because we cannot observe more than only half a sphere. Okay, and how does that extension work? So it is certainly true. I mean, if you would like to know from each direction, how much light comes from each direction, then we would not like to discretize the whole space. I mean, it would work, no? We could say we regularly sample the hemisphere into vectors and ask how much light comes from here, how much light comes from here, how much light comes from here. But one alternative to this is to use a frequency representation of the incident light. Yeah. And these are the so-called spherical harmonics. Spherical harmonics are like, people say like a Fourier transform on a sphere, but that probably sounds confusing or so. although it's true. But to keep things simple, let's just look at what these basis functions look like, the spherical harmonic basis functions. So the zero basis is what we know as the DC component from the discrete cosine transform. So it's a flat signal, yeah? Or also in the Fourier transform, it's the zero frequency. Yeah, it's a flat signal. And then at a first order spherical harmonic, it has one transition, bright, dark along one of the axes. A second order spherical harmonic has two brightness transitions in, so one in each quadrant. So here and here, here and here, here and here, here and, here and here, and here in front and on back. Yeah. So these are the zeros, first and second order basis functions of the spherical harmonics. And you can add arbitrary many levels and then obtain pretty much what is a frequency transform of your light distribution. Yeah. nevertheless, we only estimate spherical harmonics up to level 2 because there's a theoretical result that Lambertian reflectance surfaces can be perfectly modeled with spherical harmonics up to level 2. So we're not losing anything here if we make this Lambertian assumption anyways already. Yeah. Okay. So that means, so what we need to estimate in order to represent a lighting distribution along a sphere, what we need to estimate are coefficients, so weighting factors essentially, for these 9 basis functions. Yeah. So we have a weighted sum of these 9 basis functions. This means we need to estimate 9 values. Yeah. And that's all. And then we have a 3D model of all the incident lights. We're not depending on a single light source. It could also be 2 light sources, for example. But they still need to be at infinite distance because otherwise things go weird. Okay. So that is the the idea. Yeah, spherical harmonic spaces might sound scary at first, but you could also say DCT basis or so when you talk about JPEG, and then it also sounds super smart, but actually it's just a bunch of coefficients that are multiplied to some functions. and that's the same thing here. Yeah. So, so second order spherical harmonics can model arbitrary lighting environments. On Lambertian surfaces. The latter is important because the assumption that we only have diffuse reflectance acts like a low pass filter. It smoothens the lighting distribution. And this is the reason why second order spherical harmonics actually suffice to model such lighting environments. Yeah. okay, so this means that we can set up a linear system of equations with these basis functions, and we just estimate the coefficients of these basis functions. And we're still assuming we know the surface normals, we know the intensities on these surface normals. Yeah. So the solution or the coefficients, sorry, coefficients are found by solving a linear system of equations. So what we are solving essentially is a system of equations of that type. So we have some matrix M, we have our unknowns V, and we have the observed intensities B. Let me expand this. And in M, we encode the spherical harmonics. So so M equals a matrix where the math is a little bit complicated, but let's not go through the details. So we have pi, because we're operating on a sphere, times the 0,0 spherical harmonics basis evaluated for the surface normal at some position x1, in the second column we just put the second spherical harmonics basis function, so it's at level 1, and in the other direction -1, taking the surface normal of point x1, and so on and so on, until we are at the last spherical harmonics coefficient. So it's the second level. So it goes from, at first level, it goes from -1, 0, +1. At second level, it goes from -2, -1, 0, +1, +2. But these details are not so super important. Evaluated at the normal of that point, and that we fill out like one row for each of the surface points that we have. So we have the same thing for all normals of all points of the sphere, for example, that we observed. How many points do we have? P in the paper doesn't really matter. Okay. All right. So if you attended Introduction to Pattern Recognition, for example, that probably looks familiar. Yeah. So you have a matrix that determines the model. Yeah. So in that case, the spherical harmonics, but could be also like you're trying to fit a polynomial, for example, or anything else. Yeah. So that is encoded in the matrix. The unknowns are in V. So these are the values that we are actually trying to estimate. Let me write down what we have there. So V. So these are the unknowns. And these are just coefficients for our spherical harmonics basis functions. So L 0, 0, L, sorry, 1, minus 1, L 1, 0, L 1, 1, L 2, minus 2, and so on, until we have L 2, 2. Yeah, so 9 coefficients. 9 unknowns. No? That means here we need at least 9 surface points now with associated normals, but more is better because then we can estimate more robustly. And finally, B are just the intensities, so the brightnesses at these respective points. So the intensity at point 1, intensity at point 2, intensity at point 3, and so on, until intensity at point P. So we are matching the lines with the observed intensities. So these are the intensities at point X. Hi. Okay. Good. And how is such a system of equations solved? Well, you're trying to get the M on the other side of the equation. Yeah. M is not a square matrix. So you have to do a little bit of work. So the goal is to isolate B or solve for B. Sorry. No. Solve for V, the unknowns. Solve for V. So M is not a square matrix. So we transpose we multiply by the transpose of M from the left side. That means we have M transpose M V equals M transpose B. Now, a matrix transpose times the matrix is a square matrix. And that means, we have that square matrix. So we invert it and bring it on the other side. And then we have V equals M transpose M minus 1 M transpose B. Okay. And that would be then a least square solution to the problem. And what can be additionally done in order to guide the solution a little bit more is to regularize it. For example, here what Johnson and Farid propose is to put in a so-called Tikhonov regularizer. That means we prefer variations in the low frequencies of the spherical harmonics. Yeah, if we have a choice, we would better like to vary the low frequencies of the spherical harmonics. Yeah, so make solution more robust with a Tikhonov regularizer. Tikhonov regularizer may sound smart, but it's actually the simplest regularizer in the world. So we minimize MV minus B. That is what we already sort of did, or what I've shown there. Plus some regularizer C on the coefficients. And C is shaped in a way that we have a diagonal matrix with weight one, rather arbitrarily chosen, for the DC component, weight two for the first order spherical harmonics, weight three for the second order spherical harmonics. So that means if we if we have entries here in our model, so we are trying to minimize this expression. So everything that is null, zero is good. Yeah. All right. So that means if the second order spherical harmonics are non-zero, it's more important than if the lower order spherical harmonics are non-zero. Yeah. So that's more expensive. Yeah, we just say, so here this means it's more expensive to have large higher order spherical harmonics than lower order. Yeah. So it means try to express as much as you can with the lower order spherical harmonics and only use the higher order ones if you need to. No? That is what it says. Okay, and then like you can, instead of solving this, you can solve this joint thing regularized, and the full equation is, yeah, it's on the paper. Or I can also write it down. So the solution is V equals M transpose M plus lambda. Lambda is a weighting term. C transpose C, that the user has to choose. This inverse M transpose times B. Okay. Good. Now there's only one question left. What do we do in a world without gray spheres? Okay. I just show you this on pictures. So you are already a little bit spoiled because you saw the face-to-face stuff. So in principle, you know how to get surface normals. How can I get surface normals? Yeah. 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 If we have a known structure, let's say a face, then we are golden, yeah, because we have a very strong prior on how this thing should look like. No? In general, reconstructing a 3D object from a single 2D image is badly under constraint. Yeah? But if we have, if we know it's a face, then we can maybe train a little bit offline, no? And learn, all faces essentially look the same. These are just very small differences. So these differences, they move on a very low dimensional manifold. Yeah. The differences of faces. Yeah. We are moving on a, let's say 20 dimensional manifold. That's already a decent face. No. Or can say, okay, I give it 30 dimensions. Yeah. So that means with 30 parameters, we can get a face nicely specified already. Yeah. And then we have a 3D model like this. And a 3D model means we have per pixel, we have a surface normal. So we are golden. Yeah. We can take the brightness value from here. We can take the surface normal from here, put it in this equation, look up how this solution of this thing was, and compute the spherical harmonics. Yeah. Great. And that is actually what is first demonstrated in the second paper that I've uploaded to Studon. So there they manually fitted a face model to a photograph and then took the 3D normals from that. Okay. Now, if we have a slightly more general situation, that we say, okay, what if we would like to investigate lighting environments on other structures, so non-faces, no? Then we have a problem because we don't have this strong prior on the 3D structure anymore. And here's a trick that is in the first paper that by Johnson and Farid. Here's a trick how it can be operated in two dimensions. Yeah. So we have to drop all terms that refer to the C coordinate. And then, so from 9 dimensions, we get down to 5 dimensions. But this is not complicated. It's just like remove everything where you find a Z. And then look at the contours of objects. Is that, let me switch off the light. That's actually a very nice trick. Larger. Can you see this? Okay. Because you can argue at the contour, the C coordinate is like the C factor in your surface normal is 0 because you are in the image plane. So that means if you look at the intensities along the contour and estimate the normal of that contour, which essentially means, okay, look at the neighbors of this contour and somehow put a vector in, yeah? A vector in the image plane. And say, okay, the C coordinate is 0 because this is an occluding contour of an object in the scene, then you can solve the same linear system of equations. And what you're essentially doing is that you have an intensity, like a brightness distribution along the contour. You put it in these equations and you solve for the spherical harmonics coefficients, which are then in 2D only, of course. Yeah. Okay. And then it's doable. The problem is, how do you get these contours? Yeah, that's another like object detection type of problem. Johnson and Farid just said, okay, I mean, actually, we assume that we have a manual analysis, no? A forensic investigator marks these contours because there are also some other details attached. Yeah, these contours, have to be carefully chosen. And I'll talk about this in a minute, like criticism. So it's very reasonable to say, okay, we only manually select these contours. Yeah. Okay. So let's say we have either two faces that we would like to compare, or we have two contours that we would like to compare. The actual comparison is then done by taking these spherical harmonics coefficients and correlating the described light spheres. Yeah. So we compute a correlation on the described light spheres. There's a small trick also in the paper that says, okay, you don't need to extrapolate the light sphere nicely and then correlate. You can directly correlate these coefficients with some correction term. But at the end of the day, it's just a correlation. Yeah. So that is the distance measure. That is the distance measure to determine the consistency of two lighting environments. So the distance measure for lighting consistency is the correlation between the lighting environments, or between two lighting environments, V1, V2. Okay. Okay, let me make some space for some final remarks. So remarks and criticism. I mean, I really like these approaches, so I may also say something negative about it, probably without being suspicious. So, so the face or the contour, so the face in 3D or contour in 2D must be directly illuminated we must find a way to exclude self-shadowing without significant self-shadowing, because it's not in our model. What is self-shadowing? For example, if you look at my contour, my pullover does some self-shadowing. Like it has some crumbles there, and then it has some darker spots because, well, it's not perfectly flat. Yeah. So these are self shadows. You like to take them out of the contour. So the annotation, it's a royal pain, really. Oh yeah, then a particularity. So we need some simple, whatever that means. And that's actually an excellent homework. So we need some simple object color. Yeah. Remember we said, oh, it's a gray sphere. Yeah, we never talked about color again. Yeah. So the problem is color is not in our model. So if we look at the brightness variations and someone is wearing something where on the left side it's white and on the right side it's black, then we would always say, oh, he's illuminated from the white side. For faces, that's also a problem. You need, in your face model, you need to be able to deal with varying, like, for example, skin and beard or so. Yeah. But that's a problem that the face fitting people have worked on for quite a while because it's one of these notorious biometric problems. Yeah. So there it's not such a big deal. But when we talk about the 2D contours, you have to take care of all of this. So that is what means simple object color. So actually, ideally uniform. I've published a small study like 1 or 2 years ago. I've worked on this for a while also, where I put a color term in these equations. That's also doable. Yeah. But still there are many assumptions here, associated. And then still we need to do some smoothing and the usual image processing stuff to get the noise as low as possible. Additionally, smooth. This is an order. And check for other problems. Most notoriously, inhomogeneous illumination. I'll show you a couple of example pictures in a minute. These methods are particularly the 2D method, 2D contour method. Is extremely hard to apply in practice. Okay. Let me show you a couple of example pictures randomly taken from the internet. Oops, that's my okay. For example, Yeah. Uh oh. What the hell is going on? Okay. and you look at pictures like these, no? It's really like there are lights coming from top, more or less from behind. You have interreflections everywhere. So you don't even know, like by looking at this, you have no idea what your ground truth is, no? And even worse, and that becomes a problem, it could be that each person has a different lighting environment. So you cannot make a meaningful comparison because maybe the guy in front is illuminated by some light from here, while the guys in the back are illuminated from some other light source that comes from the ceiling for some reason and so on. Yeah.
So basically it violates the light source that is at distance.
Yes, yes, that's the problem, yeah. And it turns out in a lot of, I mean, in man-made environments, it's tough, no? And you have a lot of man-made environments, or let's say you have a lot of pictures of man-made environments. Yeah. I also, yeah, I don't know, I played a lot with scenes and was trying to think, okay, like in which class of scenes is it reasonable to assume that people are illuminated from, or that people are in the same lighting environment? And I really think, it should be, I mean, it should essentially be limited to outdoors, or, you could also apply special care in some specific indoor scenes, yeah? But then you need additional constraints, like a single light bulb, and then you have to put into your equation that it's okay if one person is located on the left of that light bulb, that it's illuminated from the left, and the other person is illuminated from the right, if it's on the right of that light bulb. Things like this, but then everything becomes messy, and it's not like the clean, nice method anymore where we actually started to take off. Yeah. So that's a little bit unfortunate. No. And in that sense, and that's a notorious problem of many physics-based methods, that they have very, very specific assumptions on the composition of the scene. Yeah. With statistical methods, you don't have that. No, it doesn't really matter if you compute the sensor noise on a metro scene or on another scene. Yeah, but there, of course, you are limited to the fact that you are working with digital images. Yeah, all the statistical methods are screwed if, for example, you are working on an analog photograph. Then you don't have any chance except of resorting to physics-based methods, for example. Hmm? All right. I think that's it content-wise. shall we talk about, does everyone have an exam date? So we can talk about dates right now. We also can talk about, or I can say 5 minutes something about how to prepare or so. Maybe that makes sense. Sorry, I'm going over time. I realize I'm going over time, but maybe 5 more minutes are okay or so. Or what are your questions?
This week there will still be exercise.
Yes. Yeah, right. So this Thursday is an exercise, and then yeah. And, yeah.
So when should we turn in the exercises?
We can negotiate this. Yeah. No, I'm interested in that you guys actually do the exercises. Maybe not 100%, but essentially do the exercises, yeah? But we can negotiate submission deadlines, yeah, okay. Yeah. So for the oral exam, I'm not asking deeply into these mathematical details. There are a lot of details, but I've mostly omitted them. Yeah. Nevertheless, what I would expect is, okay, first of all, it's always a good strategy to be prepared in a top-down manner. Like, okay, so we have these three big topics, no? Watermarking, stick analysis, or steganography, and image forensics, and so on and so on. What are their specific goals? Okay, so that's the usual top-down thing. And then the question is, how far do we go down? Okay, and there, I think it's clear and it's only fair to say, okay, not really to the bottom. No, I did not go through many details in the lecture. I expect you to have a look at the accompanying literature, the papers that I've uploaded, but I'm also aware that it's quite a task to dig through a lot of scientific literature if you're not in the field. Yeah, I mean, that's also clear. So, what I would expect is that you can have a reasonable conversation with me for a couple of minutes about each of these papers, but that, again, in a top-down manner, yeah? So what is the idea in this watermarking paper? And then it's like, yeah, to embed a watermark in the wavelet domain. Then, oh yeah, what does that mean? It doesn't mean anything particular. It's essentially also embedding in the high frequency component, pretty much as we also did it for the DCT domain in that other paper. Yeah, so it's like, okay, so let's talk about this, yeah? And then there are some recurring topics, like specifics of the JPEG compression algorithm. I think it's the recurring topic because it just plays a role in all three fields. So I think it's reasonable to say, okay, maybe if we can talk a little bit more about JPEG, for example, no, that should be expected, no, expected also, no. And then for each of these three fields that we have, maybe it makes sense to talk a little bit about the basic, like the fundamental assumptions. For example, in steganography, yeah, what we talked about is we can have a perfect embedding if we have a random signal. If we have a perfectly random signal, we can do a perfectly invisible embedding, and we're good. Like, we solved the problem. So what is actually the problem of steganography? The problem is that we don't have a perfectly random signal, no? But we have to deal with natural images, no? That is because it's a difficult problem, no? Otherwise it would be simple. And for watermarking, the problem is a little bit different. The problem is that we need to, for watermarking, we have to compromise a little bit, no? We also want to be imperceptible, but it's not as mission critical as for steganography. It's not the only criterion, essentially. But the other thing that the added constraint is that we want to be robust to certain operations, such that it is hard to remove the watermark from the image again. Yeah. I think these are all not very complicated things when you start to think about the reasons why we talked about that at all. these should be things that probably come to your mind anyways. Yeah, but just that it would be good that if you're not hearing these questions like for the very first time when we have that conversation, because then it probably makes a not so great impression. Okay, that's all. Yeah, and if you can add two or three equations somewhere or so, that would be great. But don't go through all the details. Yeah. Okay. More questions? Or okay, then enjoy. Oh, sorry, I did not go through the evaluation. Evaluation was good. Evaluation was actually really good. It's a pity that only four people submitted something, because it only counts from five on. I mean, it counts in terms, it like every vote counts, yeah, but there's some school of engineering threshold or so, and that like from five on it goes in some other table, and yeah, okay. So yeah, sorry. So yeah, thank you. I'm okay. Shall we talk about evaluation, or shall we, or shall you do you, shall we go home?
I think we can already switch off camera.
Yeah, we can do that. Yeah.